Welcome to the NYFC podcast. I'm Lindsay Lesher-Shoot. I spoke with Andrew Barenberg, our national policy director based in DC, about the Farm Bill. We cover what's happened so far in 2018. This is not an intro to the Farm Bill. We focus mainly on the politics because we want to get everyone up to speed in real time about what's happening. We are working on a more comprehensive overview type episode on the Farm Bill in the future. Just after our conversation, a version of the Farm Bill was passed in the House.
Okay, I am now recording.
All right, you're officially on the first NYFC podcast. So we're going to talk about this week on the Hill and the Farm Bill, what NYFC has been doing, what young farmers have been doing on the Farm Bill over the past year, but also just like what's going on, what is news this week, next week, and what's to come. But before we get to the Farm Bill, Andrew, can you just talk about who you are and your role at National Young Farmers Coalition as National Policy Director? Like, what do you do every day?
Yeah, sure. So I am in charge of NYFC's federal policy work, along with my colleague Aaron Foster West, who is our policy specialist. A lot of what we do is relationship building. We develop policies, we work with Hill offices to try and introduce bills or amendments that can influence ultimately what's in the final version of the Farm Bill. The other side of our work is down the street at USDA, and working with them to improve their services for young and beginning farmers and ranchers, help them improve their outreach to new farmers, and try and influence the way that they're implementing those programs to make sure that they're reaching the people that we want them to reach and the people that need support out there. But really, I mean, a lot of it is just trying to provide a voice for all of the young farmers and ranchers across country that we represent and organize. And so translating a lot of that into policy action on the Hill.
So you're a lobbyist. Would you call yourself a lobbyist, Andrew? Is that
exactly? It is. A lot of what we do is lobbying, whether direct or, you know, just sort of the looser definition of what that is. The difference, obviously, for us is that we are laser focused on a single issue, whereas a lot of, you know, quote unquote uppercase L lobbyist here in DC represent clients, and that's not so much what we do. I mean, we're a grassroots organization, so we're representing a single constituency that's certainly diverse, but that we're trying to just move in one direction. But yeah, we're here lobbying for young farmers every day.
So, you know, there are like some congressional staffers that do farm, right? They're like, there's a few out there.
Yeah. And actually, we've tried to make a habit of opening most of our meetings with Hill staffers with that question.
Do you farm?
Or do you come from a farm? Does your family farm? Because more and more, you know, staffers come to DC, especially if they come specifically to work on ag policy.
Right.
They're farm kids. And so that, you know, to be able to identify that immediate overlapping of interests and backgrounds, and to really just have them identify in a more visceral way with the work that we're talking about, can really help in building relationships. Unfortunately, there are not too many members of Congress that are farmers or came from farms, though there are a few. I am of the mind that we could use many more members of Congress who are also farmers.
Of course, yeah, absolutely. So I guess I'm wondering, like, how do you see, we're going to get to the Farm Bill in just a minute, but how do you see NYFC on the Hill now? Like, how are we perceived? These staffers, when you're walking into their office, what is their view of young farmers and NYFC, this sort of budding movement of young people trying to make a go of it in agriculture?
Yeah, we're still very much the new kids on the block in a lot of ways. You know, having only been around since 2010 and really had a full-time presence, in DC for only the last couple of years. And, you know, you contrast that with the two biggest farm organizations, Farm Bureau and National Farmers Union, that have been around for over 100 years. You know, we're still a tiny little seed. But I think one of the most important things we bring to the table, and why it's so important that we are in DC, is that a lot of Capitol Hill is still learning what this new, you know, resurgent young farmers movement is all about. So that's where we start a lot of our relationships, is just sort of explaining what, you know, who we're talking about, what young farmers and ranchers are, the different ways in which they're kind of entering their careers. A lot of them are structuring their businesses a little bit differently. You know, we have, thankfully, a lot of data that we've collected ourselves to illustrate, you know, what their top challenges are, how they're entering the marketplace, and just kind of illustrating what it looks like out there, which, you know, even the staffers that get home the most often, right, like, still have trouble getting outside the DC bubble. So that's why we try and bring as much information to them as possible. We have a good reputation on the Hill. Our brand is solid. I think we are seen as uniters, right? I think we bring to the table something that everyone can get behind. Because some of these issues, especially around the Farm Bill, can get so divisive, I think the broader ag community here has a pretty big appetite for the handful of issues where they can all, you know, jump into the boat at the same time and work together. And we've thankfully got one of those issues.
Andrew, I'm just wondering, you say that people can all get behind NYFC's issues. Why do you think that is? Like, what about young farmers or the issues that we're working on right now are unifying? This is such a softball question, but I'm just wondering, like, like, how is it different than the other issues that members might be asked to take a position on or get behind?
Well, for one thing, everyone's working with the same data out there, right? So we all know that the average farmer in the U.S. is getting older, that farmers are getting fewer in number and larger, and that there are fewer and far too few young people getting into agriculture if we have any hope of replacing this outgoing retiring generation. And thankfully, and thanks in part to our sounding the alarm on the other part of that equation, which is there is so much farmland that is currently being farmed by that older generation. And so those, you know, we can kind of tweak those numbers in one way or another, but the general narrative is true and for the most part accepted by basically everyone working in agriculture here in DC, that if we don't do anything, this could be a major disaster for our economy, for our rural communities, and just for, like, you know, culturally speaking, if this retiring generation, you know, leaves the farm, and there's no one to take their place. So that helps, right? Like that we're all kind of starting from that position.
Right.
And, you know, to speak of land, that's kind of the North Star of our policy work, because it is universally the biggest challenge facing young farmers right now. And I think,
but do you think the members are actually brave enough to take on those big issues in a bold way? Do you feel like you're just getting a lot of, like, nods and yeses and, you know, we'll do this, that, and the other thing that are, like, small and sort of around the edges? Or do you feel like we're sort of getting more support for, like, the real structural change that's required?
It can be frustrating. I think it's important to remember that every member of Congress and the staff they work for are operating within the current political and budget context, right? So I think we, you know, our role, and as well we should, is to call for that that moonshot, right, to protect farmland that we know is vulnerable, to support this next generation before it's too late. So I think so long as we see farm bills like the one we're, most likely going to see this year, if we see one at all, we're not going to see the kind of revolutionary structural change that we think and that we know is required. That said, I think there are some bold thinkers. I think we've created, we've illustrated the challenge well enough that people have started to imagine what this could be like 5-10 years from now if we don't start bending the curve in terms of farm demographics and the farm economy. So that's kind of a yes and no answer.
So let's talk about the farm bill. So this thing has just, what is the farm bill? Let's start from that. Like, what's your basic answer when someone says, "What is the farm bill? What is, how do you explain it to?"
So the farm bill is a massive 5-year authorization bill that impacts basically every bite of food from seed to harvest to plate. It is a large spending bill. And it is a marriage between farm programs that are administered by USDA that, things like subsidies for commodities, crop insurance, conservation programs. And then the other big part of that is nutrition programs, so-called food stamps and SNAP. Those programs make up about 3/4 of total spending in each.
The nutrition programs, right?
The nutrition programs, yeah, because they are so large. In a political sense, it tends to be one of the more bipartisan efforts. Now, as we get to the current context, I'll maybe confound some of that conventional wisdom, but. It tends to be pretty bipartisan, in part because of that nutrition title. SNAP benefits rural communities and urban communities alike. A lot of people rely on that program. And everyone realizes that we need a vibrant agricultural economy to keep food on people's plates. So it brings together a pretty diverse coalition, and it has to, because it's such a big, unwieldy bill. It's a delicate coalition that's required to pass it, and you need enough political inertia to get it to the president's desk.
So what's been happening this year with the farm bill? I guess there's a number of questions there, but like up to today, what has been going on with the farm bill process?
So the current farm bill, the 2014 farm bill, expires September of this year, September 30th, 2018. So starting immediately day one of this current Congress, so January 2017 was really in earnest the cycle to write a new farm bill. So both House and Senate agriculture committees set out and held to hold lots of hearings on most of the titles of the farm bill to kind of stage the debate and set the context for writing the next one. The House Ag Committee in particular set a very steady pace of those hearings, holding over 30 in that first year. Some of those were like out in the field hearings with farmers and stakeholders. Many more, including the one that you testified at, Lindsay, are held here in D.C. with the full committee asking questions of experts, of stakeholders, of farmers, of ag groups, to basically collect information, right? What's working, what's not working, what needs changing. So fast forward to early 2018, we saw the first draft. They started to put pen to paper late last year. We were kind of, organizations like ours were kind of like just waiting to see the first iteration, basically, of what the Farm Bill was going to be. The House released its initial draft first in April. And that was basically off to the races, right? So it was just under 1,000 pages. Every ag organization, lobbyist, staffer basically pores over those pages, performs analysis. For us, we're looking at which of our young farmer priorities and policy positions made it into the bill, which ones didn't. For the most part, the House bill was not very good for our priorities.
Right.
It maintained funding for some programs that we care about, Beginning Farm and Rancher Development Program, for instance, which trains new farmers and creates like land link programs and the like. That received current funding. Farmland conservation easements through the ASEP program, funding for that program was restored. But on the other hand, House Republicans eliminated mandatory funding for a lot of programs that young farmers rely on. Local food programs, value-added producer grants, organic cost share. A lot of the wins of the sustainable ag and local food movement over the last couple farm bills were hollowed out by the House.
Why did they do that? Like, who thought that was a good idea? Okay, maybe you can't say who, but like generally, like why, what sort of statement is being made?
Right. That's a tougher question. So a lot of it gets political in a hurry. So a lot of those programs, some of the more full-throated support of them comes from Democrats. And so by eliminating mandatory funding for some of those programs, it was a way to keep Democrats on their heels throughout the negotiating process. By, if you eliminate funding for programs that they care about, then they have to play defense and fight to restore funding for those priorities, right? Versus going on offense and trying to move the ball even further.
So it's totally, in your estimation, it's totally political. It has nothing to do with the substance. It's just Democrats, these are the programs that they spearheaded in the first place, and therefore we are going to attack them in this farm bill to distract them so they can't do other work. Is that the case, or?
That's part of it. I think a lot of the more powerful, I mean, not surprisingly, a lot of the more powerful interests and stakeholders represented here in Washington come from large-scale agriculture and agribusiness, right? So, they have many more lobbyists at their disposal. They have some of the largest organizations and have longer standing relationships than a lot of the kind of sustainable ag community may have, right? So politics, money has a lot to do with it. And
money in like how much money is being spent on lobbying efforts for one program or another?
Yes, and then,
or money as in we don't want to, we need this money for something else that we care more about.
Right. And then I think another factor too is, and this is partly politics, but it has to do with the membership of these agriculture committees. So not surprisingly, a lot of members of the House Ag Committee, for instance, come from, the Midwest, or the breadbasket states and districts that, where commodity agriculture
they don't see the value necessarily of like the direct market programs.
Right. The resurgence of that movement and the growing demand for local food has taken place around, you know, more like population centers, right? So
right.
if you are representing a district in Nebraska, for instance, that isn't in and around Omaha, let's say, then maybe you don't have as much experience hearing from farmers that are doing, you know, direct to consumer, you know, diversified vegetable sales.
So the House passes this bill, they zero out local food programs, and what else did they do in that program? Oh, the SNAP work requirements were very controversial, right?
So I buried the lead here. The most divisive part of the House bill was in the nutrition title. So in the months leading up to the release of this draft, you know, in contrast to 2017, where there was still kind of a kumbaya narrative between Republicans and Democrats on the committee, you know, we're going to do this together, we want to write a bill that we can all sign our names onto and pass it out of committee unanimously. That started to fall apart earlier this year. Democrats started to feel like they were being shut out of the process. And in particular, the ranking Democrat on the nutrition subcommittee, Jim McGovern from Massachusetts, was starting to sound the alarm that he wasn't even being consulted in, you know, as they were starting to write that part of the bill. And, you know, to this day, he claimed, which is highly unusual.
Which is highly unusual, right? I mean, the ranking member who is of the other party, right, is usually part of the negotiation.
Yes. And in fact, the way that they used to write the bill is they would have the subcommittees write their sections of the bill and then push them to the full committee, and it would kind of be stitched together. You know, this farm bill was very much the Chairman Conaway and the majority staff on the committee kept it pretty close to the vest, especially on the nutrition title. Now, the context for that is that so-called welfare reform is a major component of Speaker Paul Ryan's overall policy agenda, right? So they you started to see stories that as soon as they were finished with tax reform, which was their other big priority, they were going to move on to welfare reform, which includes food stamps. So that kind of injected some additional election year partisan politics into what's otherwise usually a pretty bipartisan process. So, you know, not long before the draft was released, every Democrat on the committee sent a letter to their top Democrat, Colin Peterson, saying, you know, until we are invited back to the table to actually craft this bill, we basically call on you, Colin Peterson, to stop negotiating with committee Republicans and with the chairman of the committee. He, you know, of course, every Democrat on his committee is telling him that this is a problem. So that is when negotiations officially went off the rails, and essentially no Democrat on the committee saw any of the text of the farm bill until we all saw it, right? Until they released it.
Which is pretty extraordinary for that to happen.
It is.
Right? Yep. Normally, committee members will have it for a time. They can prepare amendments, mm-hmm. all of the rest. Or there is some negotiation in advance of that draft even being released.
Exactly. And then an extension of that was the following week when they held their committee markup, which is when normally, you know, both parties would be offering amendments to change the bill and trying to get their priorities in there so that they can vote it out of committee with a bipartisan vote and kind of demonstrate consensus as it heads to the House floor. Democrats basically boycotted that entire process. They offered no amendments. That markup was, you know, Republicans offered a few.
So when you say markup, you're talking about the committee meeting when the whole committee comes together to look at the draft and presumably mark it up, right? Change it.
Exactly. Yeah. To they get the first stab at changing the mark, the draft of the bill. And normally that is a pretty robust process. Like there are, members of both parties offering amendments. They're debated, then they're voted on by committee members, and then things move forward. But because Democrats essentially said, you know, this bill is unworkable, this process is unworkable, you know, we ain't even gonna.
Did you go? Did you go to the committee meeting that day? Were you in the room?
I was there.
What was it like?
It was a packed room. It was, I think to start, it was incredibly tense. It obviously remained pretty tense. But for the most part, it was like members, with pre-prepared speeches and talking points, mostly talking past each other, right? I mean, it was because Democrats were not trying to make improvements to the bill, it was just an opportunity for them to highlight their big
problems
with it.
So there was no Democratic, no Democrats voted for the draft version. It got out of committee solely with Republican support, right? So then it went to the House floor and failed.
Yes. So that dynamic basically continued to the full House. Democrats and, you know, Democratic leadership instructed all of their members, don't offer amendments to this thing. It's not worth fixing. Like, let's not make it marginally better, because ultimately it's just like, you know, in our opinion, a pile of garbage.
Some Democrats did offer amendments, right?
A few did. Yep. A few kind of bucked their party leadership and offered amendments nonetheless. Very few of those amendments made it through the Rules Committee, which determines which amendments are allowed to go to the floor for consideration for the full House and which aren't. So it was a strictly governed process that was largely like preordained. They didn't let virtually any controversial amendments to the floor. There was one that we supported that Republicans offered to create beginning farmer and rancher coordinators in each state at USDA. That was just adopted by voice vote unanimously. But for the most part, our other priorities were not even allowed to be debated.
This is something that's always so confusing and surprising to me. I don't know. I guess I naively think that you want to change something and you can offer an amendment on the spot, but that is like absolutely not the case. Before it gets to the floor, it has to go through the Rules Committee. So as you were saying, it's not just any amendment that can be put forward to make a bill better. It's decided by the Rules Committee, right?
Exactly.
So Democrats really didn't have a chance to fix it.
Yeah, exactly. So the Senate process is a little different because it is the great deliberative body of Congress. But on the House side, right. There are some bills where they will have what's called an open rule, and they'll just allow virtually all amendments to go forward. But for bills like this that are really important and that can be divisive and can be closer votes, they only want to allow amendments to the floor that either are going to win them extra votes to pass the ultimate bill or that at least aren't going to compromise.
And it was also shocking, right, when the bill got to the floor that it failed, because in addition to having full knowledge of the amendments that are and control over the amendments going forward in that floor process, the leadership also knows who exactly, right, more or less, is going to vote for this bill, or they're not going to bring it up until they have adequate support. So it was quite a shock, right, that it actually didn't pass on the floor, because normally that wouldn't happen.
Yeah. It's incredibly rare that the majority party would bring a bill to the floor until they were like sure that they had the votes to pass that bill, because it's, you know, with a farm bill it's incredibly dramatic, but really with any bill it's not a good look to have the majority's bill fail on the House floor. So more often they would just like not hold the vote at all. They would pull.
So what?
It from
so tell
floor.
Us what happened. What? Why did the bill fail on the floor?
Every single Democrat voted against it, which was predicted, but they also needed most Republicans. Ultimately, the House Freedom Caucus, which is the most conservative wing of the House Republican Caucus, who normally have some problems with farm bills generally, right? It's not uncommon for very conservative members to vote against a farm bill, usually due to like fiscal conservatism. They don't like a lot of the commodity programs that they feel don't have enough restrictions. And so, you know, you have payments going to very wealthy farmers and sometimes like non-farmers. And then they also wanted tighter welfare restrictions and work requirements. They didn't think those went far enough in the House bill. But ultimately, this, because it's an election year and the farm bill is seen as a must pass, they mostly just saw that they had incredible leverage. You know, Speaker Ryan and Chairman Conaway needed their votes, and so they wanted to extract some concessions before agreeing to vote yes. That main concession was they wanted a vote on the very conservative immigration reform bill, which coincidentally is being voted on right now as we're recording this. They wanted a vote on that before they were willing to pass the farm bill. And although, you know, they were kind of assured that they would get their vote, they ultimately, the promises were not enough. And on the House floor, in very dramatic fashion, 30 Republicans voted against the farm bill and it failed.
Because they wanted the immigration vote. But there were a couple moderates in there too, right? Republicans that didn't support the final bill.
There were some moderates. Yeah. Those were bigger surprises. And, you know, I mean, obviously it's, you know, for the moderate Republicans, the work requirements were too much, right? They would have cost those moderate Republicans possibly, you know, too much politically. And then, of course, for the more conservative members, they didn't go far enough. So the needle was not thread. And the farm bill failed on the House floor in very dramatic fashion.
And then they're going to vote on it again. Is that right?
Right. That's actually, that could happen this afternoon.
This afternoon. Wow.
So Speaker Ryan at the last minute after the vote failed, used a procedural motion, that allows the bill to be brought up for a revote. And that was penciled in for June 22nd. And because they're voting on those immigration bills right now, it's possible that the farm bill is going to be re-voted on this afternoon.
Wow. And it's going to be the same exact bill. So we shouldn't expect any Democrats to vote for it. But hopefully the Freedom Caucus will get on board and also vote for this time, since they've had the immigration vote, they'll vote for it this time. So it should pass. Is that right? Okay.
Right. Yeah, that's the calculation. Now, there's even Chairman Conaway, who's, you know, it's mostly his job to count the votes and to build support for this thing. As early as, you know, as late as this morning, was saying, "I'm pretty sure we've got the votes. I'm not going to breathe a sigh of relief until they're all counted and, you know, the vote is certified."
Sure.
So we, yeah, our eyes will be glued to C-SPAN.
C-SPAN. All right. And okay, so that's the House bill. And to just, you know, on the record, National Young Farmers Coalition rejects this bill, right? We sent a grassroots action to all of our members, asking them to ask their member of Congress to vote no against the farm bill because of the cuts to local food programs, the cuts to conservation programs, which we didn't get into, but we'll probably have to talk about another time, and also because of the SNAP work requirements.
Yeah.
Is that right? What am
That's
I missing
right.
there? There's probably a number of things that also went wrong in that bill that I'm not listing there, but those are the general themes, right?
Right. Those are the headline items. There were a lot of pitches you could swing at with that bill that we were disappointed with, or you know, didn't live up to what we were talking about earlier, that we feel is required of this moment in U.S. agriculture. So And you know, it's important to say too that we did our best to improve the bill and to amend it up until the moment it was clear that was not going to happen, and we had, you know, really what we saw is no choice but to say, you know, this is not good enough, vote no. Go back to the drawing board, make it a bipartisan effort. You know, no partisan farm bill, to my knowledge, has ever passed, right? Like, this is not the way you pass a farm bill. Do better. Farmers deserve better. End of story.
Right. And so it's so frustrating in my mind, too, because it's not just that there are all these cuts, but there's, we're not seeing new ideas as much as I would like to see in a farm bill to acknowledge the new problems that young and beginning farmers are facing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's like when they are going to war over what are normally kind of like the baseline items of a farm bill, like the nutrition title, like conservation programs, then it's really hard to make space for new forward-thinking, innovative policies that we're trying to get done, right? It's like they're still fighting the old fights, and we need them to be fighting, you know, the fights of the future, and that we, well, I mean, not even of the future, of the present that we see, you know, as necessary across the country. So yeah, it is really frustrating. It's also frustrating,
but the Senate did better.
We can talk about the Senate bill. I just want to say, I mean, the other reason it's frustrating is that, you know, some of the things that we're talking about require more investment, right? In farmland protection, in farm viability, in training new farmers. And from the jump, this was sort of the farm bill of no extra money, right? We were told, you know, from the get-go, there's not going to be any extra money for more programs, for increased spending. This is a status quo farm bill at a time that, of course, that's not good enough. And of course, this is the same Congress that passed a $1.5 trillion tax reform bill, right? So that's the other really frustrating part. It's just that, you know, clearly, there's money to be spent. This is clearly not a priority. So yeah, let's talk about the Senate bill a little bit.
Yeah, something a little brighter.
So the Senate Agriculture Committee took essentially the standard farm bill approach. They spent months negotiating, Republicans and Democrats sitting down, trying to reach a consensus, a bill that had something for everyone in it that everyone could get behind. They released a bipartisan draft that both the chairman, Pat Roberts, Republican from Kansas, and Debbie Stabenow, Democrat from Michigan, both signed their names to, right? Like, they released it together. You know, the proverbial hand-holding, this is, you know, we're doing this in a bipartisan fashion. And it's no surprise that young farmer priorities fared much better in that. When you take out the partisan politics and just do the work that's required, you get a much better finished product.
And do you think that's because there's a different environment in the Senate, or the politics are different, or is it just because Roberts and Stabenow genuinely get along? Because it seems like they genuinely get along, which of course is a good place to start. But is there other contributing factors?
Well, I mean, there's the very basic reality that unless you have a supermajority in the Senate, you can't pass a party line bill of any kind. They need some Democratic votes to pass this thing. And so from the beginning, Senator Roberts said, no, we're not going to like mess with SNAP like that and inject all of these political election year things into our bill, because then we won't get Democratic votes. Like, this, it's just different in the Senate. They have to do things more bipartisan. You know, our approach at NYFC is not to rely on just one or two, you know, champions in the House and the Senate. We're trying to like diversify our political leadership in Congress. So we've spent a lot of time and energy, and our chapters have too, of like meeting with their senators and making clear what our priorities are, so that when They're kind of taking everyone's wish list. We're not on just one member's wish list, but our priorities are on many members of the committee. And so when they're adding up the votes as they're writing their compromise bill, we're more likely to get our stuff in there. And that's what happened.
It was so exciting to see our priorities actually in the Senate version, the Senate draft, and just the needs and concerns of young farmers, the same that we know they had talked about in Senate offices in district and in DC, to see those priorities actually reflected. So give me a rundown of the things that are good about the Senate draft. Like what did they get right that the House didn't?
So the Beginning Farmer and Rancher Development Program is a big priority of ours. It's like the only federal program that has beginning farmers in the title. It's one of those vulnerable programs because it's so small that if the current farm bill expires and they have to pass an extension, it's not automatically continued, right? And that's true of a lot of programs that we care about, including Beginning Farmer and Rancher Development Program and outreach and assistance to socially disadvantaged farmers, the so-called 2501 program. Those are two big priorities to us. We want to see increased funding for both of those programs. And what the Senate bill did is they merged those programs into a single pot of money so that they could create permanent mandatory funding for both of them. And what that did is that guarantees that as long as there's a farm bill, those programs will continue to exist, which is huge because previously we've kind of had to fight this fight each time to save this program.
So just like a quick clarification, just in case anyone doesn't know, socially disadvantaged is not your term or my term. It is a USDA term. Like what does it mean?
Essentially, that's farmers of color, indigenous farmers, basically farmers who have experienced discrimination, both from USDA, from private lenders, that the federal government has acknowledged have been victims of discrimination across generations, right? And so they require, we require that USDA has specific programs to ensure better access, better assistance to those types of farmers. Obviously, I think we all aspire to, a future where programs like that are not necessary. But so long as they are, we have to fight to increase funding for them, to increase investment, and to ensure access for farmers of every type. Now, the 2501 program specifically includes not only socially disadvantaged farmers, but also veteran farmers and ranchers. Veteran farmers and ranchers were added to that 2501 program in the last farm bill at the same time that funding for that program was cut in half. So that's another reason why it was one of our top priorities was restoring funding for that program, which the Senate bill more than does. So this new combined program amounts to a 150% increase in funding for outreach and assistance to socially disadvantaged farmers, which is huge.
That's incredible.
Yep.
And $50 million total for the two programs that would be split. So they would have, once you get to $50 million, you have baseline. So
exactly.
If the farm bill would fail the next time around, the funding would still continue more or less, right? Because right now, if we don't get a farm bill in September, then suddenly all these beginning farmer training programs all across the country that are depending on this federal funding through the Beginning Farmer and Rancher Development Program, they're out of luck.
Exactly. Which is, singed into our recent memory. So in 2012, Congress failed to pass a farm bill on time. And so for the entirety of 2013, those programs were not funded, which especially for programs like BFRDP that funds multi-year projects, it means projects to reach and train new farmers grind to a halt. Some organizations that rely on on grants through that program, like you have to lay off staff. It's just a disaster.
Yeah. Well, I was just going to, there are so many programs. I just want to get to the other highlights. I mean, 1,000 pages, like we'll talk right, again. But so Beginning Farm and Ranchers did well, farmers of color, right. Veteran farmers, indigenous farmers did well in terms of training programs. What about conservation programs? What about nutrition programs? What was the mm-hmm. outcome there?
Overall, there were some right. minor cuts to working lands conservation programs, which is, you know, we never like to see cuts to any of those programs. However, for the most part, conservation title overall maintained its current funding. Funding for the conservation easement program, ACEP, was close to restored. It goes from now $250 million in this current fiscal year up to $450 million. So it kind of climbs the ladder back to its historic funding levels, which is huge for land access for young farmers. That program also includes some big wins for us just in terms of programmatic reforms that will make it easier for young farmers to access farmland and for land trusts to conserve it. The local food programs that we were highlighting in the House bill, those are also not only protected, but similar to BFRDP and 2501, the Senate bill creates a consolidated program for some of those local food programs so that, again, they now would have permanent mandatory baseline funding.
So they wouldn't be stranded after a failed farm bill.
Exactly. And that's huge. Some of our other priorities, including creating beginning farmer and rancher coordinator positions at USDA to just help beginning farmers access programs. That was included. I feel like we could go all day.
We could go all day and talk. Okay, so this bill is better. This bill is still, I guess, like the House bill. We're still not getting necessarily to like the big problems. There's nothing on student loans in this bill. We're not seeing prioritization for conservation easements that keep farmland affordable to farmers. Some of the big ticket items that we're looking for in future farm bills or even this farm bill, we're still not seeing those on the agenda, but there are some really positive programs in there.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point. We are judging the Senate Farm Bill against the current context, right? So, as compared to the House bill, we're celebrating, and compared to what we could have seen in this political climate, in this fiscal climate here in D.C., this ain't bad. But at the same time, I think we have to continue to acknowledge and to agitate for a farm bill that goes beyond that, that goes beyond like the status quo and just maintaining programs, making little tweaks to improve things. Like we know that we need something much more. I think we have to just keep bringing that message to DC. And if it, if we have to build that campaign for the next farm bill, then that's what we'll do. That's what we spend most of our time thinking about and working on is how do we get to that point? How do we build that movement so that we're having, that we're writing the damn farm bill?
Yep, we would most certainly do it differently. So, Andrew, they're going to vote on this Senate bill tomorrow? Is that right?
The House bill is either going to be voted on today or tomorrow. As I said, as we're recording this, the House floor, they're debating those immigration bills. Things could change, but they're supposed to be voting on those immigration bills, which would then clear the way to have a revote on the House bill. The Senate bill has not been confirmed, but Mitch McConnell, the majority leader, has said he wants to get it done but before the July 4th recess, which would mean they'd have to move it to the floor next week.
And then there will be some amendments, certainly, to that bill?
Yes, there will be amendments. There will be a couple of big ones on commodity subsidy reform, on crop insurance. Like, those will suck up a lot of the attention. We will be working on some amendments to further improve the bill. But for the most part, we do expect this Senate bill to pass with bipartisan support. And hopefully that will mean that they'll start negotiating between House and Senate and hopefully get some kind of compromise before the September 30th deadline.
Right. So, okay. So the Senate presumably amends and then passes the bill on the Senate floor, and the House does the same, probably before the Senate, and then they go into conference committee. So that's the leadership of the Ag committees coming together, is that right? And then a few other select members and senators, and they just like duke it out. Like, what happens in that committee? Are they all in the same room? Is it a process like we see just in terms of general, you know, bill drafting? What is that like?
Yeah, so that the conference committee process gets a lot closer to your old school proverbial smoke-filled room, where it's those members and their staff going through the bill section by section, line by line, negotiating the differences between the House and the Senate bill.
And who wins? Like, how do they decide?
Well, right. So everyone's trying to exert their as much leverage as they possibly can. There's lots of horse trading, right? So I'll include this thing you like if you include this thing that we like. And then it's really complex and interesting, and you wish you could be a fly on the wall for all of these negotiations, because, you know, there's Democrat versus Republican dynamics at play, but there's also Senate versus House dynamics at play. And so there it's like, you know, you're multi four-dimensional chess being played or whatever. But the ultimate like rubric they're judging this compromise on is, can this compromise pass both the House and the Senate? And could we send it to the president's desk?
Yeah, does that give the Senate a bit of an upper hand because it might be harder to get something passed? Like,
Do
Democrats have, they certainly have some leverage.
They've got some leverage, based on how the Senate works. And for the most part, because Roberts and Stabenow are going into those negotiations as kind of a unified front on behalf of the Senate, it's could be sort of a 3-1 dynamic where it's just Michael Conaway, the chairman of the House Ag Committee, who's the one defending the SNAP work requirements and some of the cuts that they've made to conservation programs and the like. So
right, because Peterson's not going to step up and say, I like this bill, when his entire conference voted against it, presumably.
That, right, exactly. And that's, you know, that's an open question, is how he handles these negotiations. Whether he says, let's just make our bill look as close to the Senate bill as possible, or like essentially how he plays that out. There are two other big factors kind of that will hang over those negotiations. One is that the House Speaker still has final say over whether or not he'll choose to like allow that compromise conference report to go to the House floor, right? In the House, it's much more a majority rule. So, you know, if Speaker Ryan doesn't want to bring this new bipartisan compromise farm bill to the floor, then it won't go to the floor. Now, that's that's even more interesting to watch because he's retiring at the end of the year. And so his two deputies are starting to kind of duke it out over who's going to replace him in the next Congress. The other big factor is that Colin Peterson probably thinks that if the midterm elections go the way that they hope they will, he'll be chair of that committee next Congress, right? If Democrats win the House, then suddenly he might be in the driver's seat. And if they don't pass a farm bill this year, then he could be the one writing the farm bill next year.
So does he have some interest in it being a bill that can't even pass the Senate?
I would hesitate to go that far. He's been at this for a long time. He's kind of an old school conservative Democrat, incredibly moderate, bipartisan, represents a top agricultural district in his Minnesota district. So my sense is that if he had his druthers, we just get it done on time.
He wants to get it done.
Yep.
Right. Because it matters.
But that's probably not true of every House Democrat, right? So maybe they'll try and pump the brakes because they think they'll be able to write a better one next year. Who knows? That will be the really interesting part.
Exciting. Yep. All right. Well, we'll have to check in again after we have a vote in the House and the Senate and see what happens.
Yeah.
And maybe we'll have a farm bill this year.
Part two.
There's a long road ahead still.
Yes.
You're right. Okay. Thanks, Andrew. Thanks for making time for this conversation.
All right. Always happy
You're going to like turn on C-SPAN rest of the day.
Oh, yeah. Yep. I'm going to geek out on House proceedings now.
Go down and watch. Nice. Have fun with that. Okay. Well, we'll talk to you soon. Thanks so much,
Great.
Andrew.
Until then. Bye.
That is it for this week. Next week, we are going to talk to Andrew again because a lot clearly has happened. The House has already voted on its farm bill now, passed it out of the House, and the Senate is going to be marking up their farm bill next week. So we'll give you an update then.